This week on Writers, Inc.
There are certain business models that you can see associated with traditional publishing versus self-publishing. Meaning that I see self-published authors are much more able to earn a living through book sales alone. Lots of reasons for that. It also tends to benefit people who are in commercial fiction areas, who are more prolific, who write in a series, who are interested in delivering a particular experience to readers. I'm not saying traditional publishers don't care, but they're a little bit different in their attitudes.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Jenna Brown.
And I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. All right, so who got what for Christmas?
Okay, I got the coolest thing ever. And so I'm going to take over and tell you all about it. My friend got me, so there's this box by a company called Murder & Co., and there are these three true crime loving women out of LA, and they put together this whole experience. So you can get one box, which is what I got. And this thing is so detailed. So you open it up and you get a file and it gives you the instructions. And then you literally get like a case file. So you get like a medical examiner report, police report, emails, like, you know, bagged receipts, crumpled up documents. Like the detail is incredible. And so you have to sort through it all. And then to move to the next file to like get permission, you have to solve an objective. So you have to like figure out, you know, time of death or like these things that aren't laid out for you, but they're in the evidence. And so you have to go through. It is so much fun. I'm having such a nice time. I think if you like true crime, this is the detail is amazing.
Yeah, that is awesome.
That sounds awesome. But like my brain always goes to, I should be writing. Like whenever I do anything, like that's the reason I don't play video games.
Well, I looked at it kind of because as I was going through it and playing yesterday, I was like, this is actually really good writing practice because, again, just like kind of those levels of detail and things that, you know, you may not think about. It's like, oh, yeah, you could include like, you know, some reference to this and, you know, kind of how to build those clues. So I chalked it up to a whole day of writing because I was playing a game.
I want to do something like this for my books. And actually there's a friend of mine lives here locally. You guys may have met him at Author Nation, but, David Virgutz, who has this thing called Scare Mail, and it's kind of similar. Like you know, they produce these mailer boxes with like letters and, you know, newspaper clippings and things like that. So I need to talk to him about maybe doing something like that. I kind of just want to invent one of my own, like,
that would be really cool. I mean, especially because, like, you know, with like an archaeological, you know, twist, like there's a lot of like artifacts because it also comes with like, so you get things. So like it came with like this old school magnifying glass, you know, so that you can like go through and that's a clue and like just different like things that are sort of like merch related to the case. Which it's just, it's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And I am just like,
I'm sitting here watching JD's brain working. He's already thinking, I can do this.
Well, I talked to your buddy. He was on it. I think I heard him on Joanna Penn's show. And like, he's basically sending a book by snail mail, which is really cool because it gets revealed in like one letter at a time. But you know, there's a lot more to it, but like, it's just a really cool idea. So we had a quick Zoom call to try and brainstorm ideas to do something together. And we kind of hashed a few things out. And then it fell by the wayside that we ran into each other at Author Nation again. So who knows? I was hit or miss on Christmas presents. So I got my Santa got my daughter a zip line. Which, like yesterday, it was crazy cold here, and like she wanted to set it up outside. So I managed to talk her out of that. I bought her this really cool thing. It's an infinity game table. So it takes like all the old board games and it's on a touch screen. So it's like a 32-inch table that's a touch screen. But
Oh,
it's got
that's
like literally every board game you could possibly think of is built into it. And
wow.
we've got a ton of board games, but like we're always losing stuff, you know, like
Yeah.
especially with a 7-year-old, like pieces go missing. So I figured it would be a good solution for that. That has stayed in the box. Like she has like zero interest in taking that out.
Oh.
The one present she's been playing with nonstop was a pair of walkie-talkies that I got her. She's very into being a spy right now, like any kind of spy gear. So I bought her tons of things related to being a spy. But
That's
like the
cool.
walkie-talkies, like they're like on their second gen of batteries at this point. Like she hasn't turned them off. So you never
Wow.
know what's going to hit with a kid and what's not. And the
I
only thing that
know,
freaked me out about these things, I forgot that with walkie-talkies, like other people could hear you.
yeah.
Like they supposedly have like a 3-mile range, which I'm guessing is like if you're standing in an open field with no buildings between you. But you know,
Yeah.
we live on an island, so like there's not a whole lot around us. But like we were using them yesterday and we heard like another little kid talking on there, and we were trying to figure out who it was because we kind of know everybody, and then they faded away. So I think I found a channel that nobody is using, because like the idea of somebody talking to my daughter without me knowing about it really creeps me out.
Yes.
Yeah. And
But
you wouldn't think, I mean, because like who's using walkie-talkies anymore, you know?
well,
But
kids.
well, kids. Yeah, man, that was one of my favorite gifts growing up. I had a uncle who gave me an old set, but I mean, it's because like those boxy ones with the big giant pull-out antennas, you know? And man,
Yeah.
we owned our world with those things. Like we were, you know, we and they had tremendous range. Like it was like 10 miles or something. So, you know, we had a blast with those things.
My
Kind of
son
missed
had
that.
walkie-talkies and he loved them because it gave him like the illusion of freedom because he could put a walkie-talkie in his pocket.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I had one. And so he kind of was like, oh, I can go do anything, right? And, you know, but it was like, got to make sure it's in range. And then,
Yeah.
I could, you know, be like, hey, you got to come home or whatever. And so it was, he really liked it for that reason. Just sort of, he could go explore the world.
Yeah. Ours had the little Morse code decoder on it. So, in a little
Oh,
button
yeah, I
that would
remember
make a
that.
tone. Yeah. So, we would do that. None of us knew Morse code. And you would think that would have taught me Morse code, but I still don't. I only know basics. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. That's good. That's a cool gift, man. I could see why she'd prefer that over the board game thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, at
Yeah.
least for now.
For now. Yeah.
You never know going in though. You know, like there were, it took us like 2 hours to wrap everything. I always forget that part. Like we put it off until the last minute, and then like we got this giant box of stuff.
Yeah.
Like it was like 10:30 or 11 by the time we finished up, but
See, Santa
totally
didn't
worth
wrap gifts in our house. The wrapped gifts came
it.
from family. Santa didn't wrap stuff, but Santa did put stuff together. And I thinking back
Okay.
on that, I'm like, oh Jesus, that is a lot of building in the middle of the night, man.
Right.
I have a whole new respect for my stepdad now, because thinking back on like the Death Star play set, you know. By the way,
Yeah.
this Christmas marks 47 years since I have not gotten the G.I. Joe air carrier, aircraft carrier.
Not that we're
So
counting.
yeah, the only
Oh
thing that
man,
was
I
on my
remember that
Christmas
thing.
list. Yeah. All right.
I'll let Santa know.
What is in the news?
What is in the news? This is my Christmas gift, the news that I bring to you. More bold than cozy drama in the coloring book community. What it is and why it matters. After a boom in 2015 to 2016, adult coloring books were experiencing a resurgence with new, quote, bold and easy designs topping bestseller charts. Popular creators like CocoYo and Meg Publishing are leading this trend, focusing on accessible, relaxing designs with the bold lines and minimal detail. Social media, especially TikTok, has fueled the trend, with creators showcasing their coloring skills, comparing tools, and reviewing books. This has turned a relaxing hobby into a competitive space, with influencers driving demand for premium tools like Ohuhu alcohol markers, often priced over $200. CocoYo, a Vietnamese collective recently signed by Penguin Random House, has faced allegations of copying designs and leveraging AI to produce content rapidly. Their attempts to trademark phrases and styles linked to the bold and easy trend sparked backlash, leading to the cancellation of their trademark filings. The coloring community is divided over. God, this sentence is making me laugh. Sorry. The coloring community is divided over Cocowayo's practices, which some see as undermining smaller creators. While the collective has capitalized on the trend, critics argue their approach alienates the audience that helped elevate them. This is serious business.
In my brain, I keep picturing like a full-out mafia war between the
Yeah.
coloring book community, which
Yeah.
is just funny.
I had
Yeah.
no idea coloring books were so contentious. Well, when you say the mafia with the coloring books, you know, there's a maple syrup mafia up in Canada.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why not?
Okay. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a, yeah. That's, I've watched this trend since 2015. It's been interesting. And my mom 1 year, that was what she wanted was coloring books. So I got her like this entire pile of coloring books. I really don't see the problem. I mean, I know why people are objecting, I guess, if they're ha if having to be competitors to it, but like, what's the problem with using AI to generate, these color pages? Who cares? You got to get the art from somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess because that they're looking at it like all other art, you know, that
There should be a person behind that pen,
there should be a
drawing out
person
that.
behind the
Yeah. No,
pen.
nobody
Yeah.
wants to see their job go away. It doesn't
I
matter what you're
guess.
doing.
I
Yeah.
guess. Yeah, I could see it. All right. Well, coloring. And what was the see the real mafia is between Crayola and Rose Art. Like nobody
Ah.
wants the crappy Rose Art crayons. They want real authentic
Oh.
Crayola crayons.
Crayola,
Even though I'm
they
talking about? Like Rose Art's like the dollar
not a
store
clue.
brand of crayons.
I am fascinated that you even know that.
I know lots of things. All right.
There is a difference in yeah, Crayola is a superior crayon.
That's right. There's a guy here in the Austin area who has a massive Crayola collection. He's got like some of the rarest colors that were ever produced. I want
That's
to,
so
and it's all in his
interesting.
house. I don't know if he's going to build, he's talked about potentially opening it up like a museum, but like he's got rare ones from things like this pack came from the McDonald's Happy Meal in 1972. You know, he's got
Wow.
that kind of stuff. So, and colors that don't exist anywhere else. So.
Your vacation really has to go sideways when you start looking at the Crayon Museum as a
Hey
potential
man, you're
stop.
talking to the guy. I went to the American Banjo Museum in Oklahoma City, and that was a blast. That's roughly the size of this room I'm in, but it was still a lot of fun. So
Next year, Kevin, I'm taking you to the Pinball Museum here in Las
I
Vegas.
would enjoy that. I would enjoy it. There's a part that I'm a
Put it in
guy
your
who likes,
calendar.
yeah, I'm I like sort of like the older technology, I mean, I like it. It's clever. They do clever things with pinball machines, so I
Have
could
you
get
ever
it.
been to the Neon Museum here?
No.
So there's a it's the called the Bone Graveyard. It's all the old neon
Oh,
signs,
yeah.
you know,
That's cool.
and it's actually really cool. All right,
All right.
Kevin, we're going to go to at least one museum next year
We will
when you
do
are
that. All
in
right. Well,
Vegas.
let's move on to other stories so we'll have the opportunity. All right. Defendants in Tracy Wolf copyright case seek motion for reconsideration. Defendants in the Tracy Wolf plagiarism case, including Wolf, her agent Emily Sylvan Kim, Entangled Publishing, and distributor McMillan, have filed a motion of reconsideration aiming to avoid a trial and dismiss the remaining claims of copyright infringement. Plaintiff Lynn Freeman alleges that Wolf's Crave series contains, quote, overwhelming similarities to her unpublished manuscript, Blue Moon Rising. Both manuscripts featured a supernatural high school setting in Alaska, a protagonist with powers from California, and warring factions. Freeman claims to have shared over 45 versions of her manuscript with Kim, who represented both authors. Magistrate Judge Netburn previously dismissed several claims that allowed the copyright infringement allegations to proceed to trial, citing genuine factual issues regarding the similarities and access to Freeman's manuscript. The defendants argue that the judge failed to perform a direct comparison of the texts to assess probative similarity. Emily Sylvan Kim emphasizes that the case could set a concerning precedent for the creative community. She warns that moving forward with such cases without comprehensive text comparisons could discourage artistic collaboration and stifle creativity, particularly in genre fiction where shared tropes are common. So,
Yeah, this stuff all seems very common, but like it, I mean, this really puts agents in a tough position, right? Because they see so many unpublished manuscripts, and you know, anybody could come back at them later and say they lifted this or lifted that. Like the tropes that you just read off here to me seem very, you know, just something I've seen a million times. But I guess it's that particular combination.
Honestly, this is one of the reasons, you know, I'm not an agent or anything, but I mean, this is one of the reasons why I've had numerous people over the years reach out and say, "Hey, I had a great idea for a story I want to tell you about, or I wrote some a short story or a book or whatever, and they want me to take a look at it, and I won't do it." And the reason I give them, well, my main reason is I'm far too lazy to read your stuff, you know. I'm busy. But another more legitimate reason is, you know, if I see that and I happen to have a book that is similar to that in some content or context, then it gives you grounds to be able to you know, to sue me, and I don't want that. So I avoid all that. So I feel like there's this like danger zone when it comes to, you know, submitting things for representation or whatever. You know, because there was that story not too long ago about the agent who got a submission, didn't like the author's version of it, and basically solicited people, you know, on Twitter
Right,
to pitch the same story and do it better, you know. So,
Well, this is where Google is going to get all their AI generated material from. It's going to be the Gmail accounts of agents.
There it is. Yep, see?
Well, yeah, I could see
All
that
right.
happening.
Moral of the story is don't send anything to an agent.
That's the moral. That's what you should take from this.
That's my takeaway.
I do feel like this is a case for to this is this makes a case for there to be some sort of at least tentative NDA or something similar between agents and authors. Like, you know, the agent, I mean, because I mean, frankly, how can I? We're being asked to give all the trust. And I realize that there's some liability and other issues to contend with. Workload is a problem, but you know, if you're handing over your basically sometimes your life's work for consideration, I don't know. I think there should be some way to protect that.
Can you see an agent actually signing that though?
I
Like
mean,
if
I
you've got
can't.
five manuscripts in front of you and like, you know, two people are asking for an NDA before you're allowed to look at their manuscript, they're just going to say, okay, delete, delete,
Right.
and move on to the
No, I
next one.
agree. I agree. That's why it doesn't happen now. But it seems like there should be some kind of protection, but I haven't thought of what it should be yet. Go ahead, Jenna. I'm sorry.
Oh no, it's fine. I think, you know, because I kind of was following this case because I think it's so interesting, you know, they were both represented by the same agent and their manuscripts were both submitted to Entangled. And obviously, one took off and one has actually never been published. And she had said that she sent 47 versions of her manuscript to her agent. And when I read that, I thought, like,
Yeah,
wow,
that does ring of crazy, actually.
that's a lot of versions. And, you know, like I guess there's like anything in the universe, you know, like major pic, you know, summer blockbusters. Armageddon came out at the same time that
Yeah, the whole zeitgeist thing. Yeah.
yeah, there's it, things are popular, right? Especially like teenage tropes in schools. And, you know, is it possible that the agent offhandedly mentioned, you know, California and Alaska and that buried itself in another author? Like, I maybe it
Yeah.
just it seems like
Where was Twilight set? Where was that series set?
that was in
Washington State.
Washington.
Washington.
Yeah,
Okay.
Washington.
Forks, right? Is
Yeah,
that it? Yeah.
there it is. Good memory.
I should
Yeah.
know that.
You
We
would
we've actually
think.
been there. There's like two town Forks and there's another town that they mentioned in the book. And when we were out there, we actually drove through there. And like that is their like bread and butter now is the tourist trade of people coming through because of Twilight. Because they were
Yeah.
both very tiny towns that, you know, were on nobody's map prior to that. And
Yeah.
now all of a sudden all these people drive through there.
You would think that would have been set in Alaska, though, because that.
You can Airbnb their house, Bella's house. Or at least you used to be able to.
You guys know way more about Twilight than I do. All right. My entire scope of knowledge about Twilight comes from the previews of the films. That's all I know about them. All right. Here is the final story. 2024, the year in finance. Audiobook sales dominate digital formats. Audiobooks outpaced ebooks for the first time, reflecting a shift in consumer preferences towards immersive audio experiences. Partnerships with platforms like Spotify have driven significant growth in the audio market. There's like 4 points here. We'll go through them all, but fiction's continued resurgence. Adult fiction remained a major growth driver, led by popular authors like Sarah J. Maas/Moss and Freida McFadden, and trending genres like romanticy. The backlist also continued to perform well, reinforcing the importance of evergreen titles. I have a title of a book, Evergreen, just throwing that out there. Consolidation and strategic acquisitions. Large publishers like Penguin, Random House, and HarperCollins bolstered their portfolios with key acquisitions, emphasizing the ongoing trend of consolidation to stay competitive in a challenging market. And then finally, children's and educational segments face challenges. While children's and YA book sales held steady, the educational publishing sector struggled due to reduced investment from schools, highlighting pressure in certain areas of the market. That's your roundup for 2024.
Not a whole lot of surprises there. I mean, because,
No.
well, we've been reporting on this all the year, so I guess you just kind of see it. But like, print is coming back pretty strong. That's
Yeah.
probably eating into the ebook, revenue, which is why we see that down a little bit. Audiobook has been growing for years at this point. I think since they got it off of CDs and got it on your phone, and it's going to continue to grow.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that I'm seeing on the AI, audiobook narrator stuff, as much as I hate AI taking things over, within years, we're going to be able to just say that we want a female British narrator on this particular book, like when we download the book.
I think there was a
Or
key point here, though, in that it used the phrase, let me see if I can run back to it. Immersive audio experiences, right? I think
yeah, those
that's
full
key.
cast.
Yeah.
Oh, I love those.
Because
I
here's what I've
love those.
noticed. There's a market for AI audio. There are people who don't care that it was AI and they're going to buy it. There's also an equally large market, perhaps larger, for human produced audio. And then there's a whole separate market for this immersive audio stuff. So I think what we're seeing is a nice little, like, I think we've got lots of opportunities. So the opportunity for the author who can't afford to pay someone to narrate a book is that they can still have a high quality audiobook out there that people will listen to. And then from there, you can just continuously roll the cash into producing finer versions of it and better performed versions of it. I think that's what's happening.
Yeah, and it's going to keep improving.
The rest of this, was romanticia, was it a genre before 2024, or was it?
No, well, no. I mean, there's like always been a subset of fantasy that sort of was romanticy. It just was not called romanticy. So,
Okay.
yeah, I think that that kind of that term became big this year.
I'm working
And
on romantic thriller. That's what I'm working on for
I am
2024.
working on a romanticy, but a lot, if you have a strong romantic subplot, in which a lot of fantasy books tend to have, if it's not epic, then it's been like kind of a unspoken romanticy the whole time, but now they're their own thing.
Yeah. I also want to change my answer. It's going to be Thrillmance.
Thrillmance. All right.
All right. Okay. Well, that is the news for this week. This week's episode is sponsored by Readzy. If you're planning to write a book in 2025, Readzy's 3-month novel writing course can help. We often set New Year's resolutions with the best of intentions, but without an actionable plan. When you join Readzy's How to Write a Novel course, you'll get the structure and accountability you need to actually finish your draft. Each week, you'll get videos that teach you about writing craft, live master classes with your instructor and guest authors, plus feedback and access to a supportive community of writers to help you stay on track. Dive into topics like character building, plot skills, dialogue, soggy middles, and other magic ingredients that make your characters and narrative come alive. To find out more about the How to Write a Novel course, head to readzy.com/learning. The course starts on January 6th, so act before registration closes. Use coupon code WritersInc at checkout for 10% off the tuition fee. Check out this course now, and you could tick write a book off of your bucket list by spring. JD, who we got up today?
This week, we've got Jane Friedman coming on. With over 25 years in publishing, Jane's a staple in the industry. She's the co-founder of The Hot Sheet, as well as the author of books such as The Business of Being a Writer. If you want to know what's coming up next in publishing, you won't want to miss this. Jane Friedman.
Okay, Jane Friedman, you have over 25 years of experience in book publishing, and I am delighted to talk to you about it today.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so let's start with your origin story. What drew you to book publishing? How did your career begin?
Well, sometimes I joke it was a lack of options. I grew up in a very rural area, at a time when, there weren't computers, there weren't a whole lot of distractions, there weren't a whole lot of ways to entertain yourself aside from maybe reading a book or going to school. So my mother was a librarian, so certainly that had some sort of influence. But I always enjoyed reading and writing in school. Those were the subjects that I excelled in. And so it was always something. It kind of felt preordained. I was going to major in writing. I was going to pursue something related to writing and publishing. I was involved in school publications from high school into university. So it just, I've been doing the same thing now for about 30 years, and I haven't really explored any other profession.
I love that so much. So, did you get to spend a lot of time in the library when you were younger, or?
In fact, I even worked at the library for a little while because it was during a really critical time for many libraries, well, many businesses and organizations, when all of the records were getting digitized. So the card catalog had to be digitized, and I was actually helping with that.
That is like a dream job to me. Did you have a nice library where you grew up? Was it fabulous?
It was a rural area, as I
Yeah.
said, so it was very small. There wasn't a
Okay.
lot of funding, but while I was growing up, the library actually had a new building built for it. So you could tell that, like, there's obviously community investment. It was one of the
Yeah.
few places that everyone could go. It was accessible to everybody.
Yeah, that community at the library, I still remember that from being a kid too, which was so fabulous. So then you moved kind of into like big deals in publishing. You're at Writer's Digest and I believe F&W Media. What were some moments kind of in your career that maybe shaped the future of your career?
This is kind of a running theme, but the print to digital transition, just because I lived through just this really critical time for all types of media and publishing, whether you were in book publishing, magazine publishing, other forms of media. So when I started, the company that I joined, F&W Media, that was the corporate parent of Writer's Digest, they were just starting to give everyone email addresses. Websites were starting to get rolled out for all of its brands. And then, you start going through the various stages of, well, now do we need to offer products that are specifically digital? I saw the whole ebook revolution come into play, and the Kindle launching in 2007, the iPad launching in 2010. Like, they were such pivotal moments that I remember the precise years. And then you layer on top of all of that social media, which, the effects of that are still unfolding. And I remember joining MySpace and then Facebook and then Twitter. And so, and then I also saw the rise of blogging, the rise of email newsletters as a way to communicate with a readership and to market. So all of these things have dramatically influenced how I think about writing and publishing.
Yeah, and it seems like it's always changing, and maybe the media or the format is changing, but storytelling seems to mostly stay the same. I don't know if that's fair to say. People still want stories.
I do think that's true. Yes, that remains a constant.
Yeah. So you've seen all this transition, and then you transition from kind of corporate to becoming an independent entrepreneur. Was it the digital that influenced you to do that as well? Or how did that influence you to go out on your own and influence your kind of perspective on publishing?
Well, in fact, it was the threat of being fired from my
Oh.
job. So I had spent a couple years as a university professor after leaving my corporate publishing job, and I actually thought I would stay there for a very long time,
Yeah.
but I ended up taking another publishing job. I was recruited to join a literary journal in Virginia, associated with the University of Virginia, called VQR. And I stuck it out for a couple years, but it was not a good fit. And if I had stayed, I probably would have been fired. But again, continuing on that theme, I was actually brought on to help the journal better evolve and transform in the digital age. They like all of their online presence, their social media, digital versions of the publication, all of these needed to be either revamped or relaunched. And they saw that I had expertise in this. And so that's why I was brought on. But a lot of people don't actually know what they want. They may think that they want this, but it's really hard to change certain norms, certain attitudes, especially when you get into literary publishing, when you get into university environments, there's a lot of resistance to change. And there's also a lot of emphasis placed on status, prestige, status quo, and retaining all of these things that you think will continue that tradition that you value. So there was, let's suffice it to say, there was a mismatch. Maybe
Yeah.
we wanted some of the same things, but we didn't agree on how to get there. So I ended up going, I couldn't find a job really quickly enough. And so I thought, well, I'll just freelance or I'll be independent until I find my next opportunity. But it turned out I did so well on my own that
Yeah.
I've never looked back.
You made your own opportunity.
Yeah.
And you have done a remarkable job doing that. Yeah, like you said, change is difficult, and watching how the publishing industry is changing, traditional publishing for the most part kind of continues to be traditional publishing, but the indie publishing that was maybe 10, 15 years ago kind of a dirty word if you were self-published has dramatically shifted, and you have experience in both traditional and indie publishing. How has this kind of shaped your view on helping writers navigate the industry? What are your thoughts on that? That's such a wide open topic.
Well, I think that the good side of it is that there's so much more freedom for writers to blaze their own path here.
Yeah.
When I entered the industry, it was so challenging to go down any path that wasn't traditional. You had to somehow get accepted by the gatekeepers, unless you had some wealth or some connections that would allow you to be independent and to self-publish in a way that would be sustainable. But it was very, very hard. I also saw that a lot of people look down on self-publishing, especially in the traditional community. I didn't think that was fair. A lot of the people who self-published at that time had to put in double the effort to be taken seriously, and they had to have some expertise or gain skills to publish well. And so often their quality was better than what you would find from a traditional player. Of course, this is but like now, but I want to be clear, this was before like all so many revolutions in how people self-publish. This was before ebooks even.
Yeah.
So I think that the downside, so if the upside is that there's so many options now, the downside is there's a lot of confusion about what's the right path, or what if I screw this up, or how do I decide? And I think that there are certain business models that you can see associated with traditional publishing versus self-publishing. Meaning that I see self-published authors are much more able to earn a living through book sales alone. Lots of reasons for that. It also tends to benefit people who are in commercial fiction areas, who are more prolific, who write in a series, who are interested in delivering a particular experience to readers. I'm not saying traditional publishers don't care, but they're a little bit different in their attitudes. And I think the other, but so here's the other thing that's happened that I think I really appreciate seeing, and something that I think you might have been able to predict, say, 10 years ago. The stigma isn't really there anymore. Like, anyone who's holding on to the stigma is from like an entirely different era and hasn't been paying attention. So authors now can both traditionally publish and self-publish. There is a lot more flexibility from traditional publishers in striking deals with self-publishing authors, where they're willing today to say, okay, let us handle your print distribution. Let us help you get your work into bricks and mortar, or get it into translation, or get it out on a more global scale, which mm-hmm. traditional publishers are great at. And you can retain more control and rights over the digital piece. We will collaborate with you on the editions that we do. So what you see is some authors who self-publish are like moving entirely over to traditional. Others are playing both sides, and others are refusing. And so that's because every author, of course, is different. They have different goals, and they have different desires as far as control and independence. So again, it's just adding to, I think, the options that authors yeah. have, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's interesting what you said there, because, you know, it to me, the idea that it's harder to make money as a traditional author versus self-publishing, it seems like it should be the other way around. But I have, you know, in the last few years heard like, oh, the deals traditional publishing gives their debut authors are small and it's not livable. And traditional seems to be picking up these superstars of self-publishing who've made it big on TikTok or social media and giving them deals where that would have been unheard of, like probably 10 years ago, right? There's so much to unpack there. I don't even know where to start. Maybe let's start with... do you think traditional publishing is going to change at all? Do you think that it is going to be more important maybe than it was for fiction authors to have a platform to get into traditional publishing?
I mean, that's the big question in front of everybody.
Yeah.
Whether you're an author, an editor, a publisher, because you certainly see that self-publishing authors, if you look at romance in particular, these tend to be authors, the ones who are succeeding, who are quite savvy from a marketing and promotion perspective. They're very much in touch with their readers. They understand what it takes for a book to succeed, for their careers to succeed and to continue book after book. And, you know, on the traditional side of the market, there's a lot of belly aching among authors who feel like that's not my job. I want the traditional publisher to do it. I don't understand why this burden is being put on me. Only the publisher can move the needle. And obviously we see that's not true, because self-publishing authors move the needle without that assistance. Now, to be fair, there are some genres where it's more straightforward to succeed and know who your readership is: romance, science fiction, fantasy, romantasy, crime, thriller. Like, there are these very defined genres with defined, known, reachable readerships. If you're a women's fiction author, if you're writing upmarket fiction or book club fiction, if you're writing literary fiction, you know, these things have more fuzzy audiences, and maybe there are spaces where booksellers and librarians do wield a lot of power to get those books into readers' hands. And that's where traditional publishers have typically had the most influence, and where you need them to try and help get your book in front of the right people. So I think that's part of the distinction between, you know, the authors who can really succeed on the self-publishing side and those who might struggle more. I would also put the children's authors, especially picture books, middle grade, it can be a struggle to self-publish in those categories. You can find authors who've done it well and succeed, but that's not necessarily my first choice for someone just starting out.
Yeah. So this idea that traditional publishers can get you places you can't be, that's the way it's been for a long time. Do you feel like that is shifting at all? I'm particularly thinking like Simon and Schuster, with them being taken over by, is it KKR? They're operating more like a business model. And if you're having enough sales, you can kind of be your own imprint and get their distribution. And that seems like a very big shift in kind of one of the top five publishers, which is something I haven't seen before. So I'm curious on your take on that.
Well, Simon & Schuster is now owned by a private equity company,
yeah.
which, you know, does it does raise a lot of questions that are pretty interesting about what they might do in the future with Simon & Schuster and what sort of path they see forward for growing the company.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get into the weeds of that here, but I will say Simon & Schuster has certainly acquired more distribution clients. So that may be what you're seeing or referring
yeah.
to, meaning that there are a lot of small publishers out there, also hybrid publishers, which is a whole other sector of the industry, that need distribution into traditional markets. And so Simon & Schuster is only happy to take them on and distribute them. So what that means is they act as kind of the back office for fulfillment and
right.
some sales and marketing functions. And so that the publisher can just focus more on the front end of the editorial aspects, producing the books, and then, you know, hopefully they have their own marketing and publicity staff, because Simon & Schuster is not going to do everything that's required there, but they can get the books into stores or assist in getting books into stores. So traditional publishers still excel at that. And, you know, what we're seeing there is Simon & Schuster is trying to be more efficient and make the most of scale. Like they, you
yeah.
can scale when you've got more publishers that you're distributing through your warehouse, and it just makes unit costs go down. So that's part of that. But I don't see Simon & Schuster, as far as what they do with their own books, as any different than what HarperCollins or Penguin Random House is doing. I think where things have been changing for traditional publishers is that they've had to get savvier with direct-to-consumer marketing. They've had to think about, how do we market books now that there aren't as many mainstream media outlets that do book review coverage? When media is fragmented, we can't necessarily reach the market for the book by going to these two or three places that we always used to go, because now some people are on TikTok, others are on Instagram, some only look at their email, others will never be exposed to the morning shows or to billboard advertising, and some aren't going to look at the New York Times. Like, there used to be the places that they went, and
right.
that, and they've had to readjust and think about, okay, now what? If we can't rely on the bookstore or the library or these middlemen to reach our readership or to the mainstream media, how do we handle it? And I think that question is still being answered.
Yeah. And do you feel like, what do you feel the balance is between them kind of doing, trying to do more innovative things with like some of the, you know, best-selling self-published authors also do innovative things? I'm curious, like, what do you think that maybe as a self-published author, maybe besides distribution, is there anything you feel like else would be prohibitive to making your career that way? Is it marketing dollars, or what are kind of your thoughts on that?
What's prohibitive for which
for
side?
For like a, yeah, for an indie author, what might they still struggle with besides maybe getting into stores?
I think the big thing, starting out, let's say it's your first few titles, you're fairly new to the industry, perhaps. I think getting the product foundation right is actually a huge hurdle that takes a while for most authors to figure out. And by that, I mean, they might not understand what the cover needs to look like or what the marketing copy needs to be, how to categorize or add keywords on the back end so that, you know, the metadata that drives search and is really important to online retail when people are looking for the next book that they want to read. So I just see lots and lots of mistakes in that regard. And authors, fortunately, if they stick with it, they will often go back and relaunch those books where they didn't
yeah.
really get the product foundation right to begin with. I think the other thing that they struggle with initially is the need to get reviews, which just takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
There's no like secret to it. there are some shortcuts that are bad, that are like against Amazon's terms of service that I don't recommend.
Oh yeah, please don't make your friends all give you reviews, especially if you ship stuff to their house. They will find out. Like, I'm just telling you.
Advertise, like knowing how to advertise effectively, yeah. like whether that's on Amazon, Facebook, BookBub. These are skills that have to be learned, but once you learn them, then it's much easier. And I think the other thing is that what works in one genre or what works for one author, it doesn't always necessarily apply to you just because you're in the same boat. So, and part of that is just, you know, it's partly a moving target. Some of us have different strengths, and sometimes you're just appealing to a slightly different readership.
Yeah, that's good. That gave me, you're right. It's a very steep learning curve. It takes a long time to learn all the pieces that, you know, traditional publishers have experts in all of those areas, right? Marketing and covers and book blurbs, and you can do it. It just takes a decade, right? Probably.
Hopefully not that long, but at
it
least
could take a while.
Yeah. At least a few books, I would say, and you see what works. There is a service that I recommend all the time called Klytics to self-publishing authors.
Yeah.
Because they have reports that kind of distill down for you, okay, what do the top 100 books look like in this sector this year? Here are the trends. Here's what's working. Go follow this formula. And I'm not going to say it all boils down to a formula, but you need to see what works.
Yeah.
I think before you decide to deviate from what the formula is for your genre.
Yeah, especially if you're indie publishing. I have made use of Klytics. It is very useful, so agree with that. Can I bring up the thing everyone is talking about that most people don't want to, which is AI?
Yes.
How do you see storytelling or publishing adapting in the face of AI?
I mean, there are so many facets to this. And I think the more literary the writer, I actually find them to be more comfortable and less freaked out about AI, because they tend not to believe that AI is going to be able to replace human creativity. Now, I don't want to get into that debate in this very brief conversation, because you could host a whole conference arguing about it.
You sure could, yeah.
I think where I find authors more upset is whenever you're dealing on the more commercial side of the equation. This would include self-publishing authors, genre fiction, where things can be more, you know, very specific story structures, very specific tropes that readers are looking for, where you can imagine, especially the sorts of books that can be outlined, like James Patterson outlining books for other people to write. It's very easy to envision him writing an outline that his customized AI program will now write the book for him based on his instructions. So I think there are some writers who are very concerned about it in that regard, but I still have my doubts that authors, if they want to write and publish books under their own name and build a career that way, I feel like it will still be possible, because humans tend to like engaging with other humans, or the idea that there is another human on the end of this, on the other side of this. And it will probably also lead to much more investment in author platform, in branding, in things that make us feel like, okay, there is a real person on the other side, and they stand for something, and I enjoy what they do, and I've bought in to this experience. But I mean, I'm speculating.
Technology
is very new.
Right? Yeah.
It's hard to say where it's going to go, but I do think there are some sectors of publishing that stand to benefit enormously, and readers stand to benefit enormously. There's going to be so much more backlist that will be accessible to readers, because now AI narration, audiobook narration can be done economically. Translation, it's the same thing. Translation is hugely expensive. There is a tiny number of books that get translated to English from the rest of the world, because there's not enough of a sales potential there for those books to, you know, to pay the $10,000 it would take. But with AI, you could see it becoming feasible for so many books we wouldn't otherwise be able to read. So I don't fear that it's going to knock humans out of the publishing process. I don't fear that it's going to kill the profession of authorship. Will it create contraction in the publishing industry? Like, will some jobs be lost? Yes. But there's also, I would argue, not enough people working in various areas, especially marketing and promotion, you know, because traditional publishers often drop the ball there, mm-hmm. possibly with some automation and some AI tools, they can actually be better at marketing and promoting the books that they do sign. That's the optimistic view.
Yes.
I admit, but I think that's really the only view kind of worth taking if you want to stay in the business. I don't really believe in the doom and gloom. I don't like not being Pollyanna. If I see problems, I'm going to point them out, but I don't think it benefits anyone to say this is only going to be misery. I think there's still humans involved in publishing that want to work with other humans.
That has been my hope and where I keep my mindset too. So I like that take, and let's just hope that is the way it goes. I think it will. I think people always do want, I can't even get over auto-tune and like, get off my records, please. I want to hear real people singing. But anyway, so I do hope that that is the way it goes. So I want to talk a little bit about what you have coming out. You are releasing a revised edition of The Business of Being a Writer next year. What are you most excited about? How has your book evolved to address new realities in the industry?
Well, in this edition, I've pulled out a lot of material that's become outdated or irrelevant, especially related to online media, magazine publishing, because that entire space is just, it continues to be dramatically affected by technology. Yeah. And obviously now we have AI entering the picture. But full disclosure, I speak about AI very little in the book because it's just too early to say anything. By the time the book releases, it would be irrelevant. I created an entirely new section about platform. So the book has six parts. I think the first edition has five parts. This edition has six parts. There's a new part on platform. And I put it's right up front because I do think it's quite important for anyone wanting to earn a living from writing. It's, you have to start thinking about it from day one. And then there's an entirely new part about business basics in terms of taxes, legal information, business setup like LLCs, things that I wish someone had told me many years ago that I had to figure out for myself. And I feel like I just let slide until far too late. It's just, even after I was independent, I didn't have separate bank accounts and separate accounting. Until I was like 2 years in, and that's just, and it was ignorance. And I'm someone who, you know, talks about the business, and I hadn't done it.
Yeah. Why did you have to come at me like that? Platform and taxes. I'm just like hiding my head over there. I'm like, yep, those are my two weaknesses over here. So I'm going to have to run out and grab that when it comes out. I love all your stuff. I subscribe to your newsletters. Do you want to promote Electric Speed, the Hot Sheet? Tell our listeners about them because they are fabulous.
The best place to start is with my free newsletter. So that's Electric Speed. About 30,000 people subscribe. I've been doing it since 2009. And it's much lighter, let's say, than some of the discussion we've been having. It's like digital tools and resources, a brief note from me, reader recommendations. It's just kind of a what I call a media consumption guide that's very bookish and creative, and it tries to bring some joy, I hope, into the digital life that we all now lead. My paid newsletter, The Hot Sheet, is really about the industry and people who see themselves as career authors and are trying to make this work on a financial basis and want good analysis. I try to instill some calm and some reason and research into what's happening rather than relying on hearsay and anecdote.
Yeah. And I think you've instilled some calm about the direction of the industry in this podcast. So I thank you for that. Just as we're coming to a close, if there was one piece of advice you could offer aspiring writers, whether it's about platform or just anything in the world of publishing, what would it be?
Patience, because it's a long game, and I see a lot of writers give up after a handful of rejections or a handful of no's, or they try something to build their platform, and after 1 week they decide it doesn't work. This is something where in order to see the payoff, you have to be invested and committed over many years. And I hate to see people put a deadline on, oh, I have to make this work in 1 year or 2 months, because success does not, at least for writers, does not arrive on that sort of a schedule. So try to be patient with the process and be patient with yourself.
Well, I have the honor and privilege of sitting in for Christine Daigle on this today.
Who is on a terrible ride at Disneyland right now?
She's on a terrible ride at Disneyland, but that beats a excellent ride elsewhere, I think. I would love to be at Disneyland right now. Is it Disneyland or Disney World?
Disney World. She's in
Disney World. She's in
Florida.
Disney World. Yeah.
Yeah. Who wants to go to Disneyland? Nobody wants that. But she did do us a solid and send us some news stories, or some questions rather, that we can go through. So, first up, she asks, Jane's mother was a librarian. Does anyone have parents or relatives with ties to books or the publishing industry that nudged you toward writing?
I don't.
No, my aunt was a teacher. She taught, does she teach fourth grade? So going to her house every summer, which I guess I don't know why my parents used to send me to her house for a few weeks every summer, I guess.
Oh, I think we know
Oh, calm down. But
why.
it was the best summer vacation I could have ever had because she, had like this room, the guest room where I would stay, and it just had a wall of books, and it was all like the best books. And she didn't care if I stayed up late because she stayed up late. And then because she was a teacher, she had a freezer in the garage full of chocolate because, that's what teachers get. Like, man, that was the best vacation of my childhood, going to Aunt Judy and Uncle Rolf's. It was the best. I loved it. But no publishing.
I've got nothing to add to that. I've got nobody in the publishing world in my life that I can think of.
I did. So this one is, I do, in a sense, but it's weird because, so I never knew my father until I turned 38 years old and met him through, I met my sister and my paternal grandfather first and then met him. And it turned out that he too is an author. So it is there, but I
Interesting.
don't know that there was a, I mean, there's no like direct
In your
like
genes.
nurture influence there, but there may be a nature influence there. That's
Did he write archaeological thrillers?
now he wrote westerns. He writes
Okay.
westerns,
That's pretty
which I.
similar.
Yeah, that's not entirely dissimilar anyway. I mean, there's some elements in common, I guess, but yeah. I just thought it was interesting. It turned out there were a whole lot of things that he and I shared in common that were just traits and quirks of personality that we didn't, that I couldn't have learned from him. I had to have somehow inherited from him. It changed my entire perspective on the argument of nature versus nurture. I wish Christine were here actually, 'cause she would know. Like she would have something to add to this conversation. She'll tell us later. But yeah, I now believe firmly that there is a nature component, at least in
Well, I know from a little bit of the reading I've done, so Christine can correct me if I'm wrong, but like that there is a lot of innate traits that we tend to have, and all kinds of things that we don't think are genetic, but it's not a question of nature or nurture because, you can be born with certain things and certain traits and then have that, nurtured out of you or enhanced, all those different things that go into it. So it's but it is really interesting to think about how, I think about this a lot just because a lot of kids, I think we tend to put a lot of limitations on kids that we don't really realize, I think, just as a society and a culture, and just like, oh, don't do that. And some of it's fear, and some of it's, oh, we don't want them to try something and fail, and but those limitations. But if you just sort of like really nurture things and kind of notice what they're good at or interested in, I think it's really fascinating what they could
Yeah.
grow up to be.
I think I want to throw in before we move to the next question, but I learned over the weekend that if you are left-handed or right-handed, it changes the direction you look when you're trying to remember something, especially something visual. So
Yeah.
if you're right-handed, you look up and to the left. If you're left-handed, you look up and to the right. And but it gets hinky with guys like me and JD who were born left-handed and forced to become right-handed. You end up with like
Oh,
you
interesting.
become ambidextrous with it. You may look left or right.
Have you ever heard that left-handed people were actually twins that
I
ate
have heard
their
that. Yeah.
twin in the in utero?
I have heard that.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yuck.
That would explain my taste for human flesh. All right, next question. Jane said self-published authors are more able to earn a living from their books alone, especially if they write commercial fiction, are prolific and write series. The key is to have a known, reachable readership. But if you're a woman, women's fiction or upmarket literary author, it's more fuzzy and difficult to find your audience. You need booksellers and librarians to wield their power to get them. This is a long question, Christine, to get them into readers' hands. And that's where TradPub can have influence to get the book in front of the right people. What are your thoughts on all of that?
I don't know that it has anything to do with genre or style or any of that kind of stuff, right? Like we've all got the same problem, whether an indie author or a trad author. Indie authors, I think at this point, can get librarians on board, not, maybe not as easily as a trad author, but you know those avenues are open. I think it all comes down to your marketing.
It does. I
Like
do
I.
think that the advantage she may have been talking about is that like genre writing tends to follow more of a formula, and so you know you can write those a little bit faster than perhaps like a literary fiction where you know sometimes those books you know when you listen to some of those authors take 2, 3 years to write because you know it's every word matters and it's the detail, and that I do think can be a little trickier just because if you're an indie writer, getting the readership, you know, if you want to use like Kindle Unlimited, a lot of those readers tend to be like romance, thriller, you know, they want, and then they want your back catalog. And so you kind of have to be able to write faster. But outside of that, I think, you know, you could be a literary fiction writer that can find its audience.
I think so. I do think that there are certain advantages built into genre fiction because the reader is already primed to know what the tropes are. They know what they're looking for. It's an easier sell. You know, if I, you know, there's a reason I chose to write like thriller novels and things like that rather than, you know, 100 Years of Solitude or something similar, because I don't have to convince the reader that this is a book they'll enjoy. I just have to make sure that the marketing language and the cover and all that stuff resonates with them and looks and feels like the other books they already enjoy. Because, you
Yeah.
know, most of the time when we go looking for a book, we're kind of almost always looking for the same book but different, like the one we just read but better or different or faster or whatever. So, yeah, a little bit of an advantage for indies there, and plus indies know how to pivot, you know. They embrace the marketing as well as the craft, and so it's more cohesive, I think, sometimes than what I see coming out of TradPub, but it's not always the case. Let's see. Who here uses Kalytics? Any of you guys?
I used it years back. I haven't used it for
Same.
a while, though.
Yeah, same here. Yeah. I mean I think those guys were at they may have been at Author Nation too, the Kalytics guys. But yeah, I always feel bad for not using tools like this because I feel like I'm not being like the super marketing guy when I'm not like fully on board with data tools. But everyone I ever talk to who uses it swears by it. But there's a certain mindset of author that relies on things like Kalytics, and Jane Friedman is definitely one of those. Like
It's
that's her
really
whole
use.
shtick.
It's really useful when you're first starting out to try and figure out where your niche is and what you need to pursue to build it and things like that. But I think once you kind of have that dialed in, it becomes less and less important. But the data is solid. I mean, I really should probably look at it more than I do. But that's probably why I haven't. Like I feel like I kind of got that part figured out, and now it's just a matter of expanding what I already have. But when you're trying to figure out your place in the world, it's definitely useful.
All right, we'll make this our last question. The key in this industry is patience. And I remember her talking about this in the interview, but don't bail too soon. How long do you need to stick with something in publishing to know if it's working?
Forever.
That's a terrible answer. That is a terrible answer.
Why?
That's a tough question too, right? Like, I mean.
I know, man. I remember early days in my career, my wife asking me, like, okay, so when do you decide it's not working? When do you decide to move on from this and do something else? And I did not have an answer then, and I don't have an answer now. There's no obvious break point for me. Like,
I don't think that there's a definitive answer to that because publishing, like anything worth doing, is going to be hard and it's going to be a marathon, not a sprint, and it's going to take time. And sometimes you're going to have to write, four, five, eight books to get an agent. Sometimes you're going to have to write another 10 to maybe get out of the middle list area and start to have a, it takes a lot of time. And so I think the answer has to be, personal to each writer. And I think that it has to be like when you hit the threshold of, you are burned out, or, it's no longer a creative endeavor for you. It's now a slog. Like whenever you're just not, when you lose that motivation, that urge to sit down and write. And if you don't ever reach that, then I think it could be forever. Even if you're not necessarily quote unquote, successful or if it's working. But if you enjoy it, why not keep going?
I think that's the key because I've been really lucky. A lot of things kind of worked out in my favor, but like I was writing before just because I enjoyed to write. And if everything dried up tomorrow, I would still write every day. That wouldn't matter. I think if you're trying to measure whether, like if you're trying to look at your own career objectively to determine whether or not you should keep going, I would honestly go to the reviews. If your books are getting, solid reviews across the board, that means readers are into it. They like what you're doing. You're doing a good job at it. Then it's not necessarily about the writing anymore. It's more of a discoverability issue. And that can happen in so many different ways. I mean, you might stumble into the right marketing path and all of a sudden everybody knows who you are. You might write that one book that hits it out of the park and all of a sudden they, find that and then they look at your back catalog. There's so many other ways to make that happen. But if your reviews, are subpar and you've been doing this for a while and you've got a number of books out there and it's, they're not improving. I think that's probably the only time you should really take a step back and question whether it's something you should be doing.
Or what you can do different, figuring out how to get it better.
Well, there's no way I'm stopping. I mean, I've done it my whole life, and I did it for free for most of that time. So I would do it for free again if I had to. But yeah, I'm never stopping unless someone just puts a stop to me, I guess. And on that note, JD, who we got coming up next week?
Next week, we've got Wendy Dale coming on. Wendy's the author of The Memoir Engineering System, which teaches you to craft a memoir with a simple 7-step process that she built over a 15-year career path, basically deconstructing thousands of manuscripts. So if you're interested in writing a memoir, you definitely want to check this one out. Wendy Dale.
All right. And if you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.